All right, and that was Elton John with Honky Cat. Of course, we didn't play the whole thing, but we got Denise LeClaire on the line. So how are you doing this evening, Denise LeClaire?
I'm doing pretty good. And you, Ethan?
Oh, I'm doing fine. I'm getting a little tired, but everything seems to be going all right. So, you know, so it's...
You're really running a marathon show here over the holidays, so I'm not surprised that you're a little tired.
You know, it's kind of neat because it gives me... I'm up out of bed early in the morning, and I'm doing all these kinds of things getting the information out there. And then I generally go back to bed for a short nap, but I didn't get to do that today.
I remember naps. I like naps.
I know.
I don't get to do them very often, but I am very fond of them.
Yes, naps are good. So, Denise, we got some exciting stuff going on with IFGE. We got a conference coming up.
Yeah, we're coming up in just about 2 months now. We're going to have in Washington, in the Metro Washington D.C. area. We're actually going to be at the Alexandria Hilton, which is just a couple minutes from the airport, right near Old Town Alexandria. There's going to be all kinds of stuff to do. We're going to have people going to the Smithsonian and. We've got great speakers, so we're really trying to put together a heck of a shindig.
And Kelly Winters is going to be a keynote.
Yeah, Kelly Winters is going to be our keynote speaker, and right now we're planning on having Georgie Jessup, who I know is a friend of yours, and I know that you're a fan, and we're going to have Kathy Worthley on Friday night for entertainment.
Also a friend and a fan.
Yeah, so we're going to have all kinds of good stuff going on.
Oh, yeah, this is going to be really exciting. And also what happens at the IFGE conference is the Trinity Awards.
The Trinity Awards, yeah.
And this is exciting. So can you talk about who the nomination or who has won them?
I can. We're in the middle of putting out the press release right now, but there's no longer any embargo on the news, so I've been able to tell people. So one of the people who won, and bear in mind, I don't get to vote on this. I have no bearing on it whatsoever, but I'm quite thrilled to hear that Gunnar Scott, who is a good friend of mine, has won one of the Trinities this year.
Yay!
Work he's been doing here in Massachusetts and trying to organize so we can get the bill passed for non-discrimination rights and stuff. And Gunnar has just worked tirelessly in Massachusetts as long as I've known him.
I'll tell you, he gets up, and I know this because I volunteer at MTPC, and I'm there in the morning with him, and I've left him at 8 and 10 o'clock at night, and he's still been working. So it's like I you know,
I don't know anybody else who would stay in their office at 10 o'clock at night.
Well, actually I do. I've called Denise at midnight and she's been there at the office. So you know, it's the nature of the beast, baby.
Well, no less crazy, no matter who's doing it. And then one of the other winners is Spencer Bergstedt from Oregon.
Oh yes,
maybe he's Washington State. A little confused when it comes to my geography, but he's a trans man and a lawyer, and who's been doing great work out on the West Coast for a long, long time.
Yeah, for many years. Yep.
For many years.
Yes.
And last but not least, for the trifecta, we have Lisa Moté from the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, who also has been really working hard for years on behalf of the trans community, and I think that her work is even more significant in one way, which is that she herself is not trans. And so I think that when people get the word from allies rather than just from us, then they know that we're not standing alone. I think it's much more persuasive and really powerful when it comes, when, you know, the message comes, you know, about trans equality and everything from somebody else who isn't dealing with it themselves. And so I'm just absolutely thrilled with the group of people that we have this year. Interestingly enough, we have no trans women this year in the running. Now, there have been a number of years when they were all trans women and no trans men, so I suppose that this gives us equity, but it's interesting to see how the community is evolving, that some of the people who are really doing the most work now are no longer the ones who started the movement rolling so many years ago.
Right, right. And it is interesting. I mean, three wonderful choices, and... You know, I'm a fan of all three. And it's hard to believe that neither Spencer or none of them, for that matter, has received a Trinity until now. I would have thought that Lisa Moté as well would have got one before now, with her work with NGLTF and the Transgender Project. That she so tirelessly, she is one of our biggest allies. Absolutely.
Yeah, and
hands
and
down.
People who aren't familiar with what she's doing, because she's not one of the people who stands in the spotlight. She's not the person who's center stage at most of these events. She's kind of quiet for the most part. But what she's really doing is she's pounding away on the keyboard, writing the actual legislation in many cases that is getting passed in cities and states around the country.
And meeting with people, the key people, to make this stuff happen. She's a legislative lawyer.
Yeah, so she's doing these lawyerly sorts of things, which don't always get the spotlight, but that's why we have the Trinity Awards, because there's a lot of people doing great work, and they're not necessarily the people that you see on Facebook and MySpace and, you know, the ones who are grabbing the spotlight all the time. A lot of people who are doing the real hard work in the movement are doing it in a pretty quiet way.
Yep, have their nose to the grindstone, and that's it. Now, how long has the Trinities been going on?
I mean, I think we gave out the first Trinities at our first conference in 1987.
Wow.
So this would be 23 years. This will be our 23rd annual conference. And so I believe it's our 23rd set of Trinity Awards.
Nice. Now, just recently, the Virginia Prince Award has been retired.
It has been retired, and it was declared to be retired by Yvonne Cook Riley, who feels that the award, and she's entitled to be the one who retired it, because she was on the IFGE board for 20-something years, and was one of the people who started the award in the first place, but she felt that was for the people who sort of founded the movement, with Virginia Prince being one of the original founders of the movement. She's been doing activism since the 60s, when she got arrested for publishing Transvestia magazine. So she had the audacity to try to put out a magazine on transgender stuff before transgender was a word. Hell, she invented the word transgender. And so, absolutely, she was one of the founders of our movement, along with Sylvia Rivera and a lot of other people who sort of took it from different angles. But Yvonne felt that generation of people who had really started things off had pretty much had their day in the sun, and Yvonne wanted to see that we don't get hung up on the past and that we're looking more into the future, and she wants to see that we're going to do something different. If we do another Lifetime Achievement Award, she wants it to be something that reflects the way the trans community is evolving right now. And so we're not really sure what we want to do with that. So for the time being, we're letting that stay in retirement for a little while. And we're looking at coming up with a new award, perhaps, and what the new rules might be for that award and what it would be like. But I would say that, you know, the Trinity Awards really stand by themselves. I don't think that they need another award as a capstone.
Right, but I still think that, you know, as the International Foundation for Gender Education and building a culture for transgender people shouldn't let people forget who Virginia Prince was. And I think that, you know, the young people coming up that don't know who Virginia Prince is, that it's our obligation to tell them and teach them, because we want to build a culture. And, you know, that's an important thing. And
yeah, and she did important work. I'm glad that she's the one that got arrested for publishing a magazine, since I'm now in that in that line of work myself, that I don't have a real desire to go down that path. I'm more than willing to let her stand alone.
Exactly.
I don't think any more of us need to be arrested to prove our point.
And Transgender Tapestry is a phenomenal magazine. Now, how long has Transgender Tapestry been published?
Wow. Yeah, quite the torch that was passed to me with the magazine. Tapestry was started as a newsletter for the local support group in 1978.
Wow, so it started with the organization.
It was how the organization really started. If you look at the very early ones, they literally were mimeographed. And like issue number 5, they're talking about the wonderful organization that they're working on, And then Marissa, who founded IFGE and the Tiffany Club, and who was the original editor of Tapestry, calls everybody out and says, well, what do you think we should call this organization? And you can just see that it sort of almost preceded the organization, that this newsletter was what the Tiffany Club sort of coalesced around. And you can see they tried different names and debated that back and forth in the pages of Tapestry for a while before they finally settled on the Tiffany Club. And, you know, it developed along that direction for, boy, another 6 years or so, 7 years, and then Marissa decided to start doing a greater form, not greater in the form of better, but in terms of reaching out to more people. And she felt that Tapestry had evolved to the point where it was really a great vehicle to get information out about the newly burgeoning transgender community, and that sort of was a different direction than the support group was, that at some point those two things weren't growing well together. And so she split them off, and so the Tiffany Club became the Tiffany Club of New England, and IFGE was actually the original organization. So we still hold the original incorporation papers from 1970s, and we became the International Foundation for Gender Education, so we could just focus on that outreach.
And remain, and right now, the oldest and largest national transgender organization in existence.
Yeah, we've been out there for a long time. A lot of people ask me if I founded it. I'm like, oh God, no.
You were a child.
I was in high school when they started this sort of mischief.
Even I was in high school. I was a junior in 1978. I graduated in 1979, so I was 17 years old when IFGE was being formed. And that's interesting that a magazine morphed into an organization, and that it wasn't an organization that was started, and then the magazine was being published by the organization. It was the other way around.
Yeah, well, you know, if you think back before the internet, how did you even know that there were other transgender people out there in the whole world? I think it's a common experience. It certainly was my experience, that I felt I was the only person in the entire planet. Pretty sure that there was nobody else who had to deal with this. You know, and I spent years, I was a bit of a bookworm, and I spent years going through the public library in my small town, looking in every psychology textbook that they had there, all through the library, to see if there was anything that described this. And I finally found the word transvestite. But reading the definition of that just made me feel dirty. The definition that I was finding back in the 70s in the psychology books was a person who needs to wear at least one item of women's clothing in order to have a sexual climax. Well, when I read that, I had never had a sexual climax, so that just left me more confused than I started out. And it certainly didn't make me feel proud. It didn't make me feel like I was okay. It seemed like what I had was really some kind of an exotic disease.
And there was nothing there for FTMs.
No, I mean, that completely left the FTMs out. You can't be a transvestite because
Right. You
don't get off by wearing women's clothing.
Certainly no.
You know, so it's, the whole thing is kind of crazy. But that was sort of the predominant thinking of the time, because we'd all sort of hitched on to the psychology.
Well, again. And back then, think about this too. There weren't that many women that had been through college and educated, and certainly not many women psychologists or authors, so the F2M experience wasn't written about.
Years where women could actually vote at that time.
Right, so women weren't, I mean, F2Ms specifically weren't written about, because it would have been written about by somebody who had experienced that, and at that time women weren't allowed to, it was very infrequent where women went to college, or you're right, they were able to vote, or you know, we're outside of just raising a family. And whenever an FTM was, I mean, you see FTMs in history, but it was such a secret. It was very secretive that they lived these lives as men, and it wasn't really brought out. You never saw a Christine Jorgensen type of FTM. The closest is, what was his name? He was a, he played in a Billy Hall.
Not Billy Hall.
Yeah, that was a girl.
Billy Tipton,
who played in the band, and he wasn't even discovered until after his death. And he had a wife and children that he had adopted, and they didn't even know. that he was a trans man until you know, after he had passed away.
And when you look at, if you look at the social setting, then it's certainly not surprising. It's easy to understand why people wouldn't want to be known. In fact, once I finally realized that I wasn't actually a transvestite, although that's not a bad thing, that I was actually a transsexual, I still was stuck because I thought, oh my God, if I do this, every newspaper in the country is going to focus on me, because when I really researched it, I could only see one or two out there. You know, there was Jan Morris and Renee Richards and, you know, just a handful of others. And
right. And they were
they were front page news.
Yeah, they were front page news, and they were politicized, and they were, it was just, it was horrific for them. I mean, you know, even now you see the stories, and it was just like,
and I just,
oh,
you
God.
Know, really, if I had been an orphan or something, I would have probably just said, well, the hell with it, I just don't care, because I really, I couldn't care about my life before I transitioned. I really couldn't. I tried, but I was really just sort of going through the motions. But I cared for my family, and I thought, well, no matter what it does to me, that I felt that the devastation that my family would feel, you know, that they would be turned into some kind of a media circus, and
right.
they didn't deserve that. And so for a long time, even after I had sort of come to terms with who I was, I felt that I still couldn't do anything because of my family, because I didn't want to hurt my family.
You know, and even now people go through that. You know, I was with I was with a friend a couple of summers ago, you know, the staying at a family vacation spot, and she was very mindful that her brother spent time there and her other family members spent time there, and the way that the neighbors viewed everybody else's behavior. So she made sure that everybody behaved themselves, which, of course, was the correct thing to do, and to be, you know, to be aware that the neighbors didn't necessarily understand, and you didn't want the house pegged as being some sort of a trans house where other members of the family came. And you know, and it was sort of, and I watched her toil over some of these things, and I understood exactly how difficult that was. She wanted, and people were having a great time. There was no problems. Nobody, you know, did anything wrong or that would have embarrassed her family or anything. But it was still, you could tell that there was a little bit of an edge there.
Well, hey, you know, and I grew up in a small town, and I know that if I had a party when my parents were gone on vacation, they knew as soon as they got home.
Everybody
told them.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
You couldn't keep any secrets. In fact, it was such a small town that whenever I would walk into almost anywhere, and it didn't matter if it was the library or if it was the grocery store, people would take one look at me and go, oh my God, you must be Doreen LeClaire's kid. You look just like her. Which at the time totally freaked me out, because I thought, oh my God, they know.
They totally know, yeah.
You know, I just felt that there's something about me. They can tell that I'm really a girl. And it just made me even more uncomfortable, which was pretty much a feat, because I was already pretty uncomfortable. Now I take it as a huge compliment, and
right.
We do. If I sit next to my mom, people go, oh my God, this must be your daughter, which is pretty cool now.
And it's funny, because people now will say, you know, you and your brother look a lot alike. You know, you're just... And that makes me happy that, you know, that I'm not, you know, that they see me that way. And,
yeah, and your brother will get over it.
And you know what? He doesn't mind at all, actually.
Well, that's good. He shouldn't.
You know,
he
doesn't
mind.
He's
proud to have you as a brother.
And he is, and me, him. You know, I really, me and my brother have a good relationship, and I love him. And what's really neat, too, about my family and my friends, and I do this to you, and to, you know, as uncomfortable as I might make some of my friends, a lot of the times before I hang up from the telephone conversation, I'll tell them that I love them.
That's awesome, though. And then, you know what, that's one of the great things I feel about trans men, not as opposed to trans women, but just as opposed to the average man, is that trans men, as a rule, have really had to look at masculinity and what it really means in more than a superficial way.
Mm-hmm.
And where a lot of guys don't have to think about being men because they've just always been men, so what is there to think about? They think it's silly to even contemplate that as a subject.
Right.
I think for trans men, when you really start looking at it, you realize that a lot of these restrictions that we have in terms of our gender are just imaginary. They're,
it is. They're, you know, and here's a perfect example. And it's I spent on Thanksgiving Day, I went to my brother's girlfriend's house for dinner. And we will, me and my brother were watching football, and one of his buddies came in, sat down, and him and my brother proceeded to have a conversation as to why the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders have had the same outfits since like the last 20 years, and why they really needed to change them. And it wasn't about sex; it was about their clothing.
Huh.
And I looked at them both, and I'm like, you know, I mean, this isn't even something I give a rat's ass about.
Yeah, it's on the metrosexual side, huh?
Totally, totally. And my mother looked at him, and she was just shaking her head, and she looked at me, and she kept going, he should be the girl. He should have been the girl, she said.
Which probably he was less comfortable with.
Well, no, he laughed. He doesn't even care. And it's, you know, it's such a great dynamic that we all have, because he was actually nurtured more by my mother than I was. Although, you know, I mean, I remember, like if I fell in and needed a Band-Aid because I got a boo-boo, you know, my dad was more likely to console me than my brother, where my mother would have taken him and been the same way with both of us.
Huh.
But it's just, it's he... My we all went to a family wedding not that long ago, and my mother was telling me about her new dress and blah blah blah, and I honestly I love fashion, I really do, and you know that that's not an issue with me.
I am always asking you for advice,
and I tell her, well, you know, this is blah blah blah, and but my brother was like went right over her house to see her dress. And I'm going, you know, even I wouldn't do that. It's just, I never would have done that. And so she had to return it because she wanted to get something else. She didn't really like it. And I said to her, are you going to wait for Barry to come home? My brother. And she was laughing. She's like, oh, I know I should, because he'd go with me. And there's a pretty openness about gender stuff in my family,
yeah,
that I didn't even realize before I transitioned.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a funny thing too, because I would still argue that gender is very much an innate thing, that our sort of inclinations are sort of inborn. You know, I don't
right.
want to get into the, is it genetics or...
Well, there's a little bit of nurture in nature involved.
But, you know, I think a lot of this stuff really is inborn, and yet at the same time, I think that the boundaries that we put around it are the thing that's artificial. So it's not...
Right.
I mean, I think they've shown lots of studies that no matter how hard you try to raise a gender-neutral child, they still... very much congregate around gender lines.
And right.
You almost can't stop it. They tried in like the kibbutzes in Israel,
yep,
to be completely gender neutral, and they found that unless they absolutely forced, you know, people to not be in their gender roles, that even without cues around them, they would sort of naturally aggregate that way.
Yep.
But it's, so I don't object to gender. I don't think gender is an artificial construct. I don't think it's a social construct per se, but it's certainly something that we've built other things on top of. So it's those boundaries around our gender roles that are the artificial part. So I tell people, I don't mind that there's different genders. It's like having different countries. What I object to is the border patrol between them that
yes.
says you can't cross this line.
Yes, and you can't, if you're a guy and you're a man's man, then you can't possibly like the color pink. I mean, if you're, I remember when I worked at Lucent Technologies, I was a guard, and one of my jobs, and it was different on different days, but I was at the, I was badging people as they came in, and we called it the big house in North Andover because it was such a large place, and there would be lines out the door that you'd have to sign people in and blah blah. And this woman came in, she was literally in tears, and I'm like, what's the matter, you all right, you know, do you want to sit down, blah blah blah. And she's like, my husband, we took our son out to pick out, he was like three,
yeah.
He picked out a pink bicycle and her husband had a friggin' fit. And she was like, I don't understand. It's just a color. Why does he care? And the kid was really upset because the husband was upset over the idea that his male child wanted a pink bike.
Wasn't manly enough.
And it was so absurd because it doesn't make the child a girl because he likes pink or gay or trans or anything. It's a color, big fucking deal. But it really was a big deal to him, and she was just, you know, still upset. And I was like, oh my God. And they ended up, you know, solving the problem by convincing the child to buy a blue bike or a green bike.
I forget what color it was. I never saw that show where this guy kind of claims to read minds and gets people to choose exactly the thing that he wanted them to be.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so they...
Edwards.
They're not obviously out psyching their child enough.
Yeah, and it's and the thing was, and you're right, it's not... I remember choosing my toys as a kid, and I loved playing with little army men and cars and the garages. My mother bought me this elaborate dollhouse, and I turned it into a garage.
I know my parents would buy me like trucks and things like that, and I would just take them apart.
Yeah, yeah. So I cut the doll's hair.
Do it this, but oh look, it's got parts that move and spinny things, and so I would build it into something else. I'd turn it into a robot or something, but I didn't.
All my dolls look like Jack Nicholson. They had this freaking wild hair. It was like, because I'd chop it all off, and it's like, here's Johnny, you know?
Yeah, you know, it's because it's funny. People are so afraid, well, my child's going to be something less than I want them to be. You know, they're going to be identify as a girl because they like a particular color. There was a fascinating study done about 10, 15 years ago where a group of researchers wanted to come up with what is an indicator of your gender. And they specifically wanted something that would be cross-cultural because they felt that if there was something that indicated your gender by your preferences, that this should, if it was really a valid way of determining someone's gender, that it wouldn't matter whether you were in Japan or India or South Africa or Argentina or the United States, that if it was really something true, that it would be true no matter which group of people you tested. And so they looked for this cross-cultural gender indicator, and they looked at all these different possibilities. Is, well, you know, is it whether you like long hair or short hair? Is it the way that you speak? Is it whether or not you gesture? And they found, you know, some cultures, the women gesture. In Italian culture, the men do a lot of gesturing.
Yep.
It's not that. And so they went through this whole long list. In some cultures, pink is for girls, and other cultures, blue is for girls. And at one time in our culture, it was reversed, that pink was for boys and blue was for girls. And then like 150 years ago, it flipped for no particular reason. So none of those things really turned out to be valid if you stepped outside of your individual culture. And when they came right down to it, they could actually only find one thing that was always true, no matter what culture they went to, no matter who they talked to, whether you were a boy or a girl, that indicated your gender. And that was whether you felt good thinking about yourself as a girl or whether you felt good thinking about yourself as a boy, which I guess the psychologists would call ego dystonic or ego syntonic.
Right, yeah.
So if you think about being a girl and it makes you happy, you're a girl. And if you think about being a boy and it makes you happy, you're a boy.
And if you're ambivalent, then you're genderqueer.
I mean, that's something that they almost couldn't accept themselves, and they were the people who did the research. And certainly other scientists are like, well, no, that can't be it. But it is. I mean, it's that simple. What makes you feel good?
Huh.
And it's such a simple, elegant way to distill the whole thing down.
It's like asking somebody, are you happy?
Yeah. And all the other things, whether you like pink or blue, whether you like long hair or short hair, whether you like sports or ballet,
none of
those things are actually gendered.
Well, one of the funny things about that woman that I was telling you about that you know, worked at Lucent, who was so upset about her child choosing the pink bicycle, I went for a walk with her later on. We had lunch together, and I said to her, come down the hallway with me for a minute. And this made her feel better, believe it or not. Lucent Technologies in North Andover, Massachusetts, was built in the 50s. And this is probably ringing true to what you just said about color schemes. We walked down the hall, and I stopped. in front of, there's you know, a men's room on one side of the hall and a ladies' room on the other. And I said to her, look at the colors. The men's room was pink and the ladies' room was blue.
Well, see, there you go.
And people walked into the wrong bathroom constantly, and that's how I remembered to do that. I stood there and watched that happen all the time. People, because the color for the tiles were wrapped around the restroom itself, and it was an open concept, so the doorways were open, and then, you know, I mean, you couldn't see into the bathroom. But it was, and people would walk in just looking at the color and not looking at the symbol on the that was on the plaque on the outside of the wall. And I thought that's hilarious. And in the 50s, it may have been in the early 50s a different idea, or, you know, for restroom usage, you know. So I don't know. I mean, I don't. It was just. And I asked my mom, because my mother had worked, and she's like, yeah, I know. I watched that happen a lot. You know, and she's like, I don't know. You know, I don't know why they did that. Maybe the engineers got a kick out of it. Or maybe the people that built it were people from the 40s or the 30s that thought that that was the appropriate color and just didn't know that it had changed. I don't know. You know, but I nobody knew the answer. I mean, I asked people why is this like this? And it was like that in every single building on the property. You know, so it was just really funny.
Why? That's always the question.
Why?
Why? Why?
Yeah. But it was, again, maybe the engineers were just, you know, thinking that would be fun.
Yeah. Well, I'm kind of past why. I'm post why.
Oh, I don't care why, I'm trans.
I don't care why anymore. It doesn't matter. It's
no.
It's just.
It is. And it's not going to change anything if you find out why.
No.
That's even better. It doesn't change.
And in fact, it might make things worse. I sincerely believe that if they can prove why, it'll make things worse, because they're going to try to mess with it.
They're going to try to fix it.
Somebody called the other day and asked me that classic, well, if you could take a pill and make the whole thing go away, you know, would you do it? Would you do it? And that's supposed to be one of those, are you really a transsexual questions, all of which are stupid. I've never heard any of them that made any sense to me if I thought about it for more than 5 minutes.
Yeah, none of them do. And they did the same thing to me as a lesbian.
Yeah,
you know, they could cure you.
When I was young, I prayed, literally I prayed. You know, I grew up as a Catholic, went through the whole confirmation thing, and I literally prayed to have this burden lifted from my shoulders. And once I was confirmed and I didn't feel any differently, it was very frustrating for me, and sort of didn't help me have better thoughts about the church and such. But as an adult now, absolutely not. I wouldn't take the pill if I had the choice, because without having gone through the things that I went through, I wouldn't have become who I am today. And I don't know what other people think, but I kind of like the person that I am now.
Yeah.
And I don't think I'd want to be someone different. I wouldn't want to even trade places with someone else. If I could trade places with anybody in the world, I wouldn't trade places. I might want their money. I might want their car.
You know,
I wouldn't trade places with them to get those things. I'd rather be me and do just work hard to get the things that I want now. So that's a big change for me. And then afterwards, the person was like, "Well, but you know, sort of focusing on the pill. You know, do I think they're ever going to come up with a pill like that?" And I'm like, "No, they're not going to come up with a pill. It doesn't mean that they're not going to be stupid enough to spend the next 50 years looking for it."
Right.
But gender is such a complex thing that it's like thinking that you're going to tune your computer with a hammer. Taking a pill to change your gender is just not going to work. It's far, far too complex of a thing to be influenced by something like that.
And, you know, the thing is, and I'm glad that you brought that up, too, about, you know, going through all the things that you went through to be who you are. You know, as lonely or as difficult as this may seem to some people right now that are listening, who have lost, you know, family members or parts of their family, and going, yeah, you know, well, you're not in my shoes. You know, they're absolutely not. I mean, we have gone through crap, both of us, Denise and I, and it might not be to the level that some people have gone through, but we all have our own hells. And it's not really what you go through, it's how you deal with it. And here's the thing. I feel right now because I came out the other side, and I met people, and I have the relationships that I do that I'm absolutely thrilled with. You know, I wouldn't have had it any other way. Honestly, I am so happy That and I feel like I've had a unique experience, and I wouldn't trade that for the world. The experience of seeing the different genders and what, you know, I have the unique experience of knowing what it's like to live as a woman and live as a man.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's like asking somebody who's climbing Mount Everest if they'd like a lift in your helicopter. It misses the whole point.
Right.
You know, that you're there because it's a challenge. You know, in climbing Everest, perhaps it's more of a voluntary challenge than being transgender. But once you decide that it's a challenge and you're ready to take it on, then the idea of being able to just skip over it is just kind of like, well, why?
And there's people out here for you.
On the good part.
Right. And, I would have missed out. I would have missed out on every single person I got to meet along the way. And that's I wouldn't give any of them up.
I wouldn't even know you.
Exactly.
I might, but it seems pretty unlikely.
Yep, same here. I'm very unlikely that we would have met.
We just have one connection. Oh, did you know that Leo Boyce passed away, our connection?
Oh, no way.
I didn't tell you.
No, I didn't know.
Over the summer, I think around September, I got a call from my dad that Leo Boyce had passed away. And just for the rest of the people in the planet who have no idea who we're talking about, Ethan worked in
Lucent,
and Leo Boyce worked for you.
Yes.
And Leo Boyce was the best man at my dad's wedding.
And Leo used to come to work and talk me. I mean, he'd talk so much that I thought my head was going to fall off. And I remember one day.
And we can talk.
Right, and we can talk. And I remember one day saying to him, and I loved Leo. I love older people. He used to tell the best stories. And it would be incredible stories, but they were all true. And people would say, he's lying. And I'm like, no, he's not. He's not. Listen, you know, and it would be, and I'd prove that he did all the things that he said.
He did crazy stuff, too. He did crazy stuff. My best Leo Boyce story.
When he went to Yemen at 60-something years old.
Yeah, because he was an Army medic.
Yes, he went to Yemen. And nobody believed that he actually was getting deployed to Yemen. And I'm like, no, I have his paperwork.
Yep. Leo's really doing it. But when he went to Yemen, his son's name is Leo also, and he let his son use his pickup truck. And I remember seeing him when he came back from there, and he was all pissed off because his son had traded his pickup truck in and bought himself a really fancy new one.
That's hilarious.
And he was so mad, but it wasn't anything he could do because the truck was long gone, and his son's name was Leo, so nobody looked at it twice. And boy, he was mad at his kid for a long time about that.
That's pretty funny, but it's now this is the connection that Denise and I have. But regardless, I mean, I knew that Denise was at IFGE because I knew Nancy Kane, who was the prior executive director. So I knew that Denise was there. And then when I realized that Leo was living in the same town that you were living in and that you knew each other, and Leo used to be, he was blah, blah, blah one day, and he was just blah, 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 and I couldn't shut him up to save my life, and I had to be somewhere else, and I said, Leo, I know somebody that you know. And he looked at me, and he said, who? And I said, Denise LeClaire. And he opened his mouth, and then he shut it again, and then he opened it, and then he shut it again, and then he just walked away.
Well, it's pretty much the same reaction my dad had when I told him that Leo worked for a friend of mine, and my dad's like, yeah, who? I said, Ethan St. Pierre, he's trans. And he's like, like you are? I said, well, kind of, but he's male to female. I mean, he's female to male.
Right, going in the opposite direction.
My dad's jaw went out, and he closed, it opened, it closed, and he goes, they go in both directions?
They go in both directions. Oh,
it was the first time he'd even considered the idea that there were F to M's as well as M to F's. Now, speaking of which, I promised I'd go over my dad's house and help him with
yes.
the generator that we're sharing. So I'm going to have to jump in my car, but I can call you back as soon as I'm underway.
And that's fine, because I have to pee.
Okay. And how long do you have me blocked out here for time?
As long as you want. It's all up to you, and I think that we're having a really good string of
conversations. You don't have somebody coming on right after?
I do, but their time slot it's not a solid slot, so.
It's a mushy slot.
It's a mushy slot, yeah, so it's fine. It's fine.
Fungible.
Because they're actually scheduled within the next few days, so.
Oh. Okay.
So it's fine. It was the just in case, you know, the conversation didn't, you know, go very far or you had to do something.
So when we come back from the break, I can explain to everybody why I need to go help with the generator.
Yes, and that's...
when I'm done, I'm going to bring it to my house.
That's a real good thing, too.
Because we're having a winter wonderland effect out here.
And actually, I talked to Maxine Morris, who lives in Merrimack, New Hampshire, earlier. We talked to her, and she read a poem about the trees crackling and snapping and popping.
Oh, it was fabulous.
Yeah, so we'll talk about that when you come back, and okay. We'll you know why you need to do this with your dad.
All right.
So we'll talk to you later.
Your meds.
All righty.
Bye.
Bye bye. All right, I promise I'll play that song when we come back on. We got Denise LeClaire back, and the conversation will continue. That's this is really good, so I'm excited about talking rather than listening to the song.
Well, I have to say I'm kind of jealous. I think I like your job better than mine. You mostly have to, like, talk a lot, and I'm really good at that.
I know, that's what I'm saying. It's
and the pay is about the same, so.
Yeah, we both get nothing, I know.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's well, you know, one of the and this is the thing, I decided that there are a couple of things that I'm good at, and I thought that I could just utilize them for our community, and one of them is absolutely, you know, talking. I'm a yapper. Got the yapping gene from my mom.
You got to go with your strengths.
Right. I mean, I figure I couldn't make a living at shopping, so it had to be talking.
Yeah. And I was such a shy child, you know, so it's kind of stunning for people when I tell them, no, when I grew up, I was completely shy. I was totally an introvert, and I still really kind of identify as an introvert. And yet somehow the yapping gene has become expressed at a later age, and I can keep 3 or 4 phone lines fairly busy.
You know, that's honestly, I think that we were the same child. I was extremely shy. I wouldn't really speak that much unless I was spoken to. And it wasn't because my parents ever expressed that that's the way that I needed to be. It was just I didn't feel very comfortable with myself. So I think that I didn't have enough confidence to speak. You know, and that's probably what it was. More than the idea that, well, you know, I just didn't, and it wasn't about me being raised as a girl. It wasn't really about that or that women, that's what women's places were. It was just that I didn't feel comfortable talking because I wasn't comfortable with myself. So
yeah, I wasn't comfortable in my own skin. How could I be comfortable trying to relate to other people?
Right. Or, you know, speaking, I felt I was very insecure that I was saying something stupid or that it was wrong or that people were going to laugh at me and, you know, just a gazillion other things. I just didn't feel right about being me. So, you know, exactly. And now I just, you know, well.
Now you just can't shut us up.
It's all downhill from here.
Just can't shut us up.
Exactly.
Now, can you hear me okay? Because I'm driving now on the highway.
Oh, yeah, you're doing a good job. I can hear you just fine.
Okay, cool. Just coming through Waltham. It's a real winter wonderland up here in Massachusetts. I don't know what just happened, but traffic was all snarled up, and there was water spurting out of the middle of the street.
Well, that's always wonderful. And it's going to turn to ice.
Yeah, it was like in the Beverly Hillbillies, you know, and they shot the gun, and oil came a bubbling crude. It looked just like that shot from the Beverly Hillbillies. All you think is just water.
Yeah, it was no black gold, no Texas tea.
No, I ain't going to Beverly Hills. Oh, well. I'm stuck between Boston and D.C. for the foreseeable future. With a little side trip out to the frozen tundra of Gardner, Massachusetts, where I grew up and still own a house. You know, I don't spend a lot of time there. And my parents still live.
Now you're going to your dad's house. Is that where you're going?
Yeah, because I lent him the generator that I had to borrow, because none of us have had electricity out there since Thursday night when the ice storm came through. And the storm took down a number of trees at my house. The place I got seemed really cool back in the day when I was younger and a little more butch. And now I'm like, what was I thinking? So it's like way out in the woods, and I've got a phone pole halfway up my driveway because it's too far for the electric lines. And I lost a whole bunch of trees that came down and just ripped all the wires out of my phone poles. But that's okay because nobody else had electricity either, so... The whole town is still pretty much out, although they did get the bank up online yesterday, which was good.
Yeah.
My dad's house still has no electricity, and my house still hasn't got any electricity.
Ooh, and I know that was... you now, in your water pump that pumps the water from your well to your faucet runs off of electricity, so you were really afraid...
Yeah, I don't have city water, I don't have city sewer. I suppose I should be grateful that they can run DSL out that far in the woods. But that's not working too good now either, since all those wires have been torn up. So it's been really interesting. I spent the weekend with my boyfriend, and both have our own chainsaws. And so we have his and hers chainsaws going out, cutting up all these trees that fell down in the yard and dragging them up the driveway. But it's okay because I've got a wood stove, and we'll use the wood.
Right, actually, that part isn't, you use it to heat your house so that your pipes don't freeze.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's, I know, we were with, and it was not nearly like that here. I mean, it was a little scary because we just didn't know what was going to happen.
How long were you out of electricity? You were still out of electricity for like 2 days, right?
Yep, it was 2 days, but I could still run my water.
You at least had water.
Right, to keep my pipes from freezing. And inside my house never got below 45 degrees. Even though it was freezing outside, I was really kind of amazed. And my mom had a generator. My mom lives next door. So Karen and I went over there and sat and talked to my mother and stepfather for a while, and it was pretty good to be able to do that. But we were all a little nervous about how long this was going to take, and people were fighting at the gas pumps, cutting.
I know, with the stock market crashing and everything all stopped, there's a state of emergency, no electricity, people fighting at the gas pump. Seemed like the end of the world for a while. It's like, what is going on?
Well,
things are just unraveling.
It was ridiculous that people were fighting at the gas pumps because there was plenty, and there wasn't like there was just one gas station open. All of the gas stations in the city of Haverhill pretty much were open. So the idea that people were in a pissing contest over who should go next, I thought that, you know what, should have a cop at each gas station just telling, okay, now you come next, and now it's your turn. And I mean, because
banks, so all the National Guard were at the banks.
Well, National Guard.
The alarm systems worked for the banks.
Right. The National Guard, sure, I can understand that, but... You know, I mean, there was just, we have volunteer police officers, too, in Haverhill, and so they could have come out and actually done something to keep the peace. It was insane that we needed to, though. You know, there were lines coming in.
It's amazing how fast common civility breaks down.
You'd think that during a crisis that people would be more willing to help each other rather than fight.
Well, there's a certain point in a crisis, I think, where that does kick in, but the crisis has to be bad enough where people actually stop and take a look at what they're doing and think about things a little bit more serious. I think you look at, like, after 9/11, people in New York were very cooperative. You know, when there's a really big disaster, people do tend to be cooperative. But I think at this point, it was sort of a borderline disaster. It wasn't really strong enough to snap people out of their own thinking, you know?
Their own selfishness. It wasn't severe enough to be grateful to be alive. It was enough to be annoyed, but not enough to be grateful to be alive. So that, you know, people were gonna edge each other out just to get what they needed at that moment because they didn't want to wait in line. It was inconvenient more than it was a life crisis.
Right, but that makes it just like the mall at Christmas time, which is another place I really don't want to be.
And I shop online, baby. There's nothing better. Amazon.com.
Oh, yeah, definitely shopping online.
You know what? I bought myself a Christmas present. Well, two this year, and it was new foam for my... I have a really nice pair of headphones that needed new foam, and I found them on Amazon, and a nose for my microphone. I got a Bozo nose.
Well, all right.
Yeah, it's gray. It's not the they do sell them in pink, but I didn't buy the pink one.
Yeah, for the first time in 10 years, I have a Christmas tree. Actually, it's at the IFGE office though, because there's electricity to run it there, and it's actually the top of the pine tree that fell across my electric line. And so it snapped off, and it looks very much like a Charlie Brown Christmas tree because it's a pine tree, not a spruce tree.
Yep.
So it's just little puffs of needles at the end of long twigs. So it looks kind of funny, but I thought, well, what the heck, why waste it, right? I was coming into work after the big storm, so I just threw it in the back of my van in a Christmas tree stand, and we set it up in the IFGE lobby. But I suppose I shouldn't call it a Christmas tree because I'm more open-minded than that and a little more pagan than that in most respects. So we'll call it a Yuletide tree.
A Yuletide tree. And you know what? I really want to take the opportunity to, Denise, to say thank you for the work that you do with IFGE and on behalf of the transgender community. And what you do is is generally a pretty thankless job. People think, well, you're an executive director. You must get paid oodles of dollars and blah, blah, blah. And that's not the case. And you work a lot of hours and put a lot of effort into keeping IFGE the way that it is, and that is serving the transgender community. The stuff that IFGE does, most people don't see. And that might be answering phone calls at the office and helping a person through a personal crisis, be it a cross-dresser or whatever the case may be. And producing the magazine, putting out letters to let everybody know what's going on, what's happening in our community. Putting on a conference. There's a lot of sleepless nights, and there's a lot of hours that go into doing any of this stuff. And, you know, Denise does most of that. There's you, and there's two part-time people at the office. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, Nancy is there part-time, a couple days every other week taking care of the accounting. Joan comes in every week and handles membership stuff. And Shirley's there 3 days a week.
For the bookstore.
We have a lot of other people who do jobs. We're sort of decentralized. So Larissa Glasser's doing the layout on the magazine. And, you know, so we have different people who are taking different aspects of work on. And I'm trying to orchestrate this as much as possible.
Right,
but it's a lot of stuff. It's definitely a lot of stuff. But, you know, my motivation is like I was saying earlier, when I was in the library and I was looking for information and the information wasn't there. And even now, you think, well, there's the internet. But try to find a support group in your town. If you check on Google, you're going to find 10 support groups, 9 of which the websites don't work or the information's out of date. You know, so there's really hard to find any place that has up-to-date information that's going to be accurate at all. And so, you know, I see IFGE as being that place where people can get answers, and we provide background information for a lot of other places, for a lot of other journalists. So, you know, every week we're getting calls from the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, or USA Today. We've worked with a lot of TV stations and radio stations, and every once in a while, just for practice, I like to go on a right-wing talk show and let them call me strange names and argue Bible stuff with me. Keeps you in good shape. I feel really strongly about that. That really needs to be there for people because it wasn't there when I was looking for it, and I know what kind of a difference it would have made for me.
Right.
So I think that's really important, and as long as I'm able to do it, I feel very privileged to be in a position where I can do it.
You know, when I first, and as connected as I was to the community long before I transitioned, I called IFGE the day that I needed to go to a therapist to get everything that I wanted to have happen. It was IFGE that I called. You know, it wasn't anybody else. It wasn't any political organization. It was IFGE. And, you know, I got the answers that I needed. You know, oh, here's a therapist for you. Here's their numbers. And if you don't want to see this person, here's another one right here. So,
yeah, it's not glamorous. It's more like something like the Red Cross. You know,
exactly.
You know, get to hang out with movie stars and stuff like that. We get to deal with lots of yucky stuff sometimes.
It's the reality.
It's work that makes a difference to people, and ultimately, yep. You know, that's the big thing is that it helps people, and it helps educate the public when we work with the media and places like that, so that they get better information out to people, and they have a better idea of what we deal with as individuals, and see us more as people.
Yep. And I'm really proud to be part of IFGE. I really am. I never thought that, you know, that any of the work that I would do would be, important enough to somebody to say, well, you know, maybe we should have this person be on our board of directors because, you know, they understand what's going on in our community and they have enough connections to, you know, and I'm really excited about that. I've been on the board now for, almost 2 years, right?
Yeah, and you know, I think you totally deserve to be there because you're doing this kind of work already because you're getting information out to people, you're letting people know that they're not alone, mm-hmm. and when, you know, for at least for the moment they are alone over the holidays and things like that, then you give them that sense of connection back to the rest of the community. So I think the work that you're doing is very much in the same light as IFGE's mission.
Well, and
I think you're great asset to have on the board.
Oh, thank you very much. You know, and that's part of, you know, and it was IFGE that taught me that this is the important stuff. Well, for me anyways, this is the important stuff. And I got to tell you, we got a lot of people that are backing this up. You know, there's yourself and there's, we got everybody that you can imagine in the community right now that's coming on the show to talk and to give people that little light of hope. And that's, you know, that is the line of IFGE. And that's, you know, that's the basics. And it's not, you're right, it's not pretty, but it's the basics. It's the part that I believe that's, you know, that makes the difference in people's lives before they can move on to do anything else, to become an activist or decide whatever else they want to do, is to pick yourself up by the bootstraps. And what better way than to have a friend there telling you that it's okay?
It's sort of like the Statue of Liberty for the trans community, where, yep. where that little torch where people can look towards and see that, you know, that there's something better over the horizon. And we welcome all these newcomers because the trans community is entirely a nation. It's a whole community of immigrants.
Yep.
You know, we didn't all grow up in the same town. We didn't all take the same classes in school. We're not all the same race. We're not all the same gender. But yeah, we are part of this community. And so we're all sort of immigrants there. And when you're coming into a new community, I think it's incredibly important to have somebody there to welcome you.
Well,
to let you know that it's going to be okay.
And you're right, like you're saying, you know, coming into a new country or coming into a new gender, it is having somebody there to tell you it is going to be all right. It is going to be okay.
Yeah,
We've been through this.
It's going to be all right, and you're all right. I think that's the most important part is to let people know that they're okay, that there's nothing wrong with them.
There's nothing wrong with them at all. It's good people, that you're a good person and you deserve all the happiness in the world. It's just, it's, you know, because there are people in your world telling you that that's not the case. Don't believe them. There are people out here that know that that's not true, that are living this, that are saying, you know,
yeah.
Look, we've been through it and we care about you.
The people who are telling us that we're not okay are in such positions of power that it's very easy to internalize that message. When you have people who claim that they speak for God, when you have priests and ministers out there condemning us just for being who we are, you know, and calling us abominations and things like that, how can a young person not internalize that message? How could that not affect your self-esteem? Even if nobody else in the whole world knows how you feel, even if you've never done anything to express how you feel, you know inside how you do feel. And then when you hear people talk about you like that, then it's just crushing. And I think that probably has a lot to do with why so many of us are introverts.
And also, you know, you can even take that to, you know, some people won't give a rat's ass if their pastor, their minister, or their priest says it, but when their parents or their spouse says it.
When your teachers and your classmates, I mean, you hear it everywhere.
And you know, there are people that will care about you. That's not, you know, it's not to say that, and like, you know, I was talking about this earlier, you know, during the week, that just because they don't get it right now, it doesn't mean they're not going to. But it also doesn't mean that you have to hold on to that hope forever and think that they are your life. Move on and just let them be. And if they decide sometime to come around, you know, welcome them with open arms and with love. They just took them a little longer. But don't accept that's their, you know, that this is... This is all there is.
You can't demand acceptance.
Right. You can't. You're right. You can't. But you know what? There are people out there and right here that do accept you. So.
Yeah.
You know.
There's a community out here.
That's awesome.
For people who are, you know, wondering, it's like, no, it's not. You hate to say, come on in, the water's fine. Because, you know, there's certainly.
There's shocks.
Life's more complicated to be out as a transgender person. It's not something you need to really think about. But at least you should know that you're all right, and that whatever decision you make to stay in the closet or not to stay in the closet, that you're still okay.
Right, that you're a good person, and that's fine. You know, and you're right. You can't say, you know, come in, the water's fine, because there are sharks in that water. But, you know, it's how you deal with them and what's happening. So it's, you know, it's all up to your whatever is going on in your life. But it doesn't make you a bad person. You're right, no matter what they decide to do. But just know that if you feel really alone right now, it doesn't always have to be that way, and it doesn't mean that it's going to. There are people in your life, or will be people in your life. There's people in our community that are awesome. Join a social network. Join a support group. Call IFGE. Get information. Go on the internet.
Yeah, call IFG.
Start.
God knows that we're there all kinds of strange hours.
I know.
And if you're in Waltham, you can come see our Charlie Brown Christmas tree in the lobby.
That's right. That's right. I need to make that trip, too. You know, but it's seriously, it's, you know, so many caring people that I've met that, you know, it's, and even though there are people out here that have political differences, you know what? When push comes to shove, the people generally in the transgender community will push that stuff aside to help you when it comes right down to brass tacks. I've experienced that myself, and I think that there are many others out there that have too. You will find friends in the most unlikely places.
I think we're pretty unlikely.
Yeah. That's cool.
Wow, you know, there's so much stuff to I think I could probably spend the next day talking with you about all the different things that are going on. I went to go see my endocrinologist the other day, who's Dr. Norman Spack. I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. Spack, but he's doing some really great work. He's the head of endocrinology at Children's Hospital, and he works with transgender youth. And people come all the way from Europe, fly over here just so that their kids can see him, because, you know, really on the forefront. And he's one of the few doctors anywhere who's using the hormone suppressing therapy to delay the onset of puberty.
And he's been working with trans people since the 70s, by the way.
What's that?
He's been working with trans people since the 70s.
Yeah, he's like member number 100 in IFGE's membership role. And he's been doing a lot of work, and he's coming out with some research really soon that I can only say a little bit about. But there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes medically. Not so much in terms of how it's going to change, you know, the drugs or something that we're going to use, but in how we're seen by the medical community. One of the things is that he's one of the authors of the new Endocrine Society's guidelines on treating transgender people. And it's not like there was an old standard for treating transgender people. There was never a standard at all, because it was never accepted in greater circles as being something that you could standardize, that it was something that's relatively common in that there was agreement on what you do in this situation. And so in conjunction with a number of other doctors, I think there's five or six different authors that worked together on this, they came up with a 64-page set of guidelines on how to work with transgender clients, and it goes into everything, including the work that Dr. Stack's been doing on delaying the onset of puberty and all the different things that, you know, how you would determine when to do this and what kind of things are appropriate and all that. It's going to have a lot of impact because in a lot of ways it's going to legitimize treating transgender people from an endocrine perspective.
And that's why
it just becomes that much less of a radical thing.
And no, that's what Karen and I had Dr. Daniel Fetterman, was our endocrinologist for a long time, and he retired and just started teaching. Continued teaching. He always was teaching in Boston, but he was Dr. Fetterman did. Where was he, Karen? He was the
endocrinologist.
Yes, Karen. Thank you. The dean of Harvard Medical School. And he was teaching his third and fourth year students on how to treat transgender people. And when I went to, transsexual people, and when I went to him initially, because he had been treating Karen already, he never charged us. He said, I just want to write about you in the American, you know, medical journal. Is that okay? And I said, sure. And he looked at me and he said, you just need hormones. He said, I can't believe you've never taken them before. He examined me. We went through a battery of tests, blood work, the whole nine yards. And it was wonderful that he took such great care. He even started me off on a small amount of testosterone and increased it and then did the proper things. And I really felt that he was very careful about my health. He didn't want to just give me, smack me with a giant amount of testosterone all at once. He eased me into it. He did all the right things. And I really, here's this 70-year-old man with a little guy with a bow tie. And I'm looking at him thinking, this guy is not going to be able to understand what I'm going through. And he totally got it. So I think that he might even be one of the people working with Dr. Spack. In fact, I'd be surprised if he wasn't.
He might be. One of the other people working with Dr. Spack is Edgar Del Menviel, who's the head of psychiatry. Or maybe psychology, I'm sorry, at Children's Hospital in Washington, D.C.
Right.
And he's working, co-authoring a paper with Dr. Spack. He's agreed to be a presenter at the IFG conference also in D.C. and
nice.
Talk about the work that they've been doing. It's pretty amazing stuff. They've been studying the rates of suicidal tendencies among transgender-identified kids. And, you know, the rates are crazy high. I think they said that the background rate of suicidal ideation, they call it, was something like 35% or in that ballpark,
wow.
Which is an incredibly high rate. And they've been examining how it's affected by going to see an endocrinologist and, you know, if you're treated with the hormones, does this make it better or does it make it worse? And the results are amazing. It seems to really have a profound effect on these kids.
Yep.
And I think that this is going to be another thing that goes a long ways towards making mainstream medicine see that this is legitimate treatment for a legitimate condition.
Right, and the American Medical Association took that first step to this year by saying that transsexuality is a legitimate medical condition and that doctors need to treat it as such. I think it's Article 128 on the front page of their website that talks about that.
So these things are all adding up when you look at it. It's coming from different places. You know, you got the AMA, the Endocrine Society, and all these different professional organizations gathering around and coming up with guidelines. And, you know, and this is all impact beyond the fact of what the guidelines are there in the first place for. Because certainly the guidelines that they're developing through the Endocrine Society aren't to make a political statement, but it's to say, well, these are what we're typically using, that we're usually using spironolactone. This is the dosage range that we're typically using. These are the acceptable forms of estrogen, and these are the ones that you shouldn't really use because they've been shown to cause problems. Because without this background information, anybody who treats transgender people is reinventing the wheel. And we don't need that. As a community, we deserve better health care. This stuff is known. They know which forms of estrogen cause more blood clots. They know, you know, a lot of the different side effects, but they don't have a way to get that information widely distributed. And so this is going to be huge in terms of getting all the doctors the latest information so that they can make sound judgments when they're deciding what kind of treatments to use. But then beyond that, then there's the political impact, which is also huge. So, you know, these are the kind of quiet things that are going on that people don't really see because they're not making headlines, but that 10 years from now are going to have a huge impact on how our community's health care needs are addressed.
I think it'll be sooner than that because I think it's going to be a need to have this information inserted in our healthcare system, because if we have any sort of national healthcare, we really need to be inserted in that. And if we're not, I don't want to be excluded, you know. And that's the whole thing. Transgender people should not be excluded from treatment. So
yeah, I mean, in a way, national health care is definitely going to be a challenge in terms of treating transgender people, because if it doesn't cover us, arguably it's not really much worse than it is right now, because most of us are not covered. If we let it be known what the hormones are for, or what the therapy is for, a lot of insurance companies are just going to reject the charges. The vast majority will. And so if the federal government takes over health care and it's doing the same thing, that's not so bad. But the hard part is that it's much harder to change when the government is doing something than it is to change the individual insurance companies. And certainly that's pretty hard in the first place. And I think whatever is considered to be acceptable and standard treatments when national health care does get enacted, and I do think it's inevitable that it will be, that we're going to be stuck with what we have at that point in time. And so making as much progress as we can before national health care is implemented, I think, is a really critical thing.
What's that? Hang on. Lisa Gillinger. Oh, Lisa Gillinger. Do you know Lisa Gillinger? Denise?
I'm not sure. I'm having a hard time hearing you. It's kind of noisy.
Oh, sorry. Lisa, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi.
Well, you know what? I'm probably hogging her time anyway. I've been on the phone with you for like an hour and a half. So I think I'll sign off and pay attention to driving for a little while.
I know. You gotta go. You're going to be at your dad's anyway, so it's...
Yeah, I'm going to be at my dad's trying to get the generator hooked in so he can get his furnace started. Not a very feminine sort of thing, but like we were saying before, who cares about gender? You do what you have to do,
you
right?
You do what you got to do.
Oh,
Denise...
Yeah.
And Denise, you're welcome on the air any other time during the week, of course, and up until, you know, and including December 25th. So we'd love to have you. You know, just we'll be in touch with each other during the week.
Okay, very cool.
Thanks for letting
me have the time on the air with you. Have a good night, everybody.
All right, good night, Denise.
Bye bye.